I usually try to stay pretty well informed with current events, but a couple of weeks ago I was in Florida at a meeting and there for most of the week. And when we go to our meetings, it's like from 7 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night that we're doing something. And I don't think I turned the TV on in my hotel room the entire time. And there isn't any time to listen to the radio or watch the news or anything like that because you have breakfast. And then you go from there to larger meetings. And when everybody gets together, 1,200 people, and then to smaller meetings with 14 people or 12 people in your own district. And there you meet with them for the rest of the day. And then by the time you get out at 5 o'clock, there's time to maybe have a quick change of clothes. And then they've got dinner plans, going out someplace. And like what the awards evening that we had, we went to the Jacksonville Jaguars Stadium and had our banquet with our Western region, about 120 people in one of the lounges that they have. It was very nice. But as a result, I didn't watch the news at all. And coming home through Dallas, we had a two-hour layover in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and me and one of my colleagues here in Tucson were on the same flight, and we popped into a Chili's restaurant, and they had a flat-screen TV, and all of a sudden, for the first time, although it had begun several days earlier, I saw all this unrest in the streets in Egypt. And, people are rioting and, there's tanks gathering. And I mean, I'm just coming into the movie kind of halfway and not really knowing what's preceded it. And, it was kind of one of those strange things. I mean, this has not happened. Something like this is kind of momentous. And if you're like me, when something like this happens, you begin to think, what are the ramifications on biblical prophecy? Did anybody else begin to think that? I'm not the only one, right? So I do see your hands, and that's good. And we still don't know how it's going to turn out. There's several scenarios. Now the army's in control. Hosni Mubarak has stepped down. And I immediately began to think, what obviously some of you began to think about were the Suez Canal and how important that is to the world's commerce, how important that is to oil being trafficked through the through the Mediterranean, up into Europe, or over to the United States. It's a nice shortcut. That's why it was built many, many years ago. That's why the Panama Canal was built many, many years ago. It provides a shortcut, from east to west or north to south. And that vital chokehold is one of the things that we recognize, along with other things that have been in the control, to a certain extent, have been open and free for commerce. And if that becomes shut, if that were to become shut, maybe it wouldn't be the end of the world, but it would put a cramp on a lot of people's style. It would, it could lead to other major events, as we know. So I was thinking about those things as I was sitting in the restaurant and waiting to come home to Tucson a couple of weeks ago. But understanding Bible prophecy can be very complex, because sometimes when an event like that happens, you want to understand it in the context of, is there anything in the Bible about this? Or is there, will it lead to anything else, right? And I began to think about it. The most momentous events in the history of our country in the last 100 years are not even, well, they may be covered in generality in the Bible, but just that. World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, all of these are events that shaped our lives in a big way. But you're not going to find any reference of them in the Bible at all, except in the most vague and general terms, which I'll go over with you today. But I have found that, and you have found too, I mean, I don't think I'm alone in this, that unless you have a really good foundation and framework of understanding the Bible and Bible prophecy, it's easy to maybe jump to conclusions when something's really significant at the moment happens. And this may be something that leads to something else, right? We know that. Or it may recede in prominence and it may become something inconsequential in the overall scheme of Bible prophecy. It's kind of like I've said before, you're not going to find this in the Bible, but prophecy is like the waves of the ocean. If you spend any time, you see the waves coming in and receding and coming in and receding. And, sometimes you have a tidal wave, and hopefully you're not around when that happens, but, sometimes it's just wave action. Sometimes events in the course of human history are like just like wave action. Nothing really consequential, but you know, even Christ said that that was the case, as we'll get to in just a little bit. But I found it's not really necessary to understand every nuance or actually even ascribe any significance to the events that happen on a regular basis. This may be something, again, as I said, that leads to something else far of greater significance, but it might not. But as a framework, we have many different passages that we can go to, and I'll ask you to turn to 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19, and we'll get into a little bit about what Peter is talking about in the first century AD as he's speaking to people who actually were in the church and they were a part of the 12 tribes of Israel. We know that for sure. And although I don't have my notes, I turn to it in 1 Peter chapter 1. I'll go back there in just a second. But in 2 Peter, first of all, in chapter 1 and verse 19, it says, "And so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." So by Peter, Bible prophecy is compared to a light. And the lights that they had in the early first century were oil-lit lamps. So at nighttime, if you can imagine yourself not even with a Coleman lamp, which are very popular for camping, but just a very faint, very, very faint, like kind of like the flashlight that we have in our drawer right now where the batteries are run down. In the pitch black of night, with that old rayon flashlight with its batteries worn down and kind of wandering through the house and trying to find something, that's about the power of light that Peter is talking about. Enough to keep you from running into the wall, but, you know, you're still not seeing everything, right? So prophecy is like that. It's a light that provides enough visibility until the kingdom of God comes. And as such, even looking into the Bible, if you had perfect understanding of every Bible prophecy, you know what? You're not going to make every call right on the money. And when an event like what has happened in the last couple of weeks in Egypt come to pass, you know, you're probably going to be as surprised as the next person, even though what do you have? You have better than he does. He's going to run into the wall. And, you know, if you listen to the news commentators, you're going to hear a dozen different opinions as to what could happen and what might happen. Well, you know that right now, I think what you would come to is you could say, 2 weeks period of time and unrest. Things are a little bit more peaceful now. It could very well be that the military could give way to some kind of free election system, and maybe, as many people would fear, maybe it won't turn into an Islamic fundamentalist state governed by religion. You know, maybe it won't. And that's probably the way most people are thinking now. Or it could. You just don't know, right? So, but the betting money is probably on the fact that probably going to be stable. Now watch next week. I'll be wrong and, you know, they'll be rioting again and, you know, everybody or somebody will overtake the army. You know, you just can't tell. I mean, so it's interesting. So when you think about Bible prophecy, it's a guide in a dark place, helping us to understand our place in the world. But the main thing is you're looking at it from a prism and a perspective of the Bible, which most people admittedly are not. Now in 1 Peter chapter 1, and in verse 10, you know, we are in a great place as the people of God and as the church of God. We're in a good place because Peter also says, "Of this salvation the prophets have inquired and searched carefully, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in them was indicating when he testified beforehand that the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow." They didn't know when it was going to happen. You know, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they prophesied of things that would happen in the future, but oftentimes, you know, weren't given that. Just like Daniel, we read of Daniel. He wanted to know, when would these things be? Oh, it's not for you to know. It's not for you to know, Daniel. Close the book. Shut it up. It's for the time of the end. So To them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which angels desire to look into. Now, this was given, interestingly enough, if you'll take a look at the first verse of 1 Peter. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the pilgrims of the diaspora in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father and sanctification of the Spirit for obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ. The tribes of Israel had migrated at that time in the first century to the area of, you know, directly north of Jerusalem. They had moved in that, well, they had been there for some time. But now there were people in the church as the gospel had been spread. This is written in the latter part of the first century AD. But as the gospel message had been spread, churches had been established in these areas. And there were members of God's church from the other tribes of Israel now in the church. And Peter is writing to them and telling them about the truth. And so that's who it was. So that's who the audience was at that particular time. But now the message is to us, descendants of the 12 tribes who are in the church of God at this particular time. So it's written to the people of God, and it applies to all of God's people. Prophecy is among the things that the angels desire to look into. And of course, we do as well. There are many interesting ways to approach prophecy, and I'm going to give you one of them today by covering several principles of prophecy that I think are very helpful and establish a framework for evaluating what happens now, what happens in the future. And so I'm going to cover several principles of prophecy. And the first one I'd like to turn to, or the first one, is illustrated in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24 and verse 32. And this first principle is, you know, you can put it any way you want in your notes, remembering the parable of the fig tree or the principle of the fig tree. I just kind of made this one up, by the way. This is of my own creation, a principle that I think is kind of important when you're thinking about events like the one that we've just been through, as a matter of fact. Because when you examine, you know, the history of the United States, as I said, I'm not knowing if I'm repeating myself at this point in the sermon, since I gave it this morning in Sierra Vista, so you'll have to bear with me. The short-term memory is not as good as it was. Well, I can't remember when. But anyway, you know, think about the greatest events of our country's history: the Revolution, Civil War, the Emancipation, World Wars I and II, not even touched in Bible prophecy. Vietnam, none of that, nothing even touched in Bible prophecy. So when you're evaluating Bible prophecy, or when you're thinking that something is going to be really significant, you know, maybe back down just a bit and remember this principle in Matthew 24. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, know that it is near at the doors. He's gone through the Olivet prophecy and, you know, all of the things, you know, famine and pestilence and war and rumors of wars and all of those things. When you see those things happening at the same time, then know it's near at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. So this is a very important principle in understanding Bible prophecy, understanding your part in the whole context of Bible prophecy. Christ has already said there would be these events that would precede his coming: wars, rumors of wars, famines, pestilence, earthquake, tribulation, false prophets, heavenly signs. Also mentioned in Revelation 6. But he said, learn the parable of the fig tree. You know, prophecy, or world events, not prophecy, but world events, like nature, can sometimes register a false signal. In other words, we had a real cold snap a couple of weeks ago, right? Really bad cold. And frozen things, froze my fruit trees in the backyard. They're a disaster now because I'm not smart enough, apparently, to go out and cover them up. And so a lot of dead limbs and branches. I have no idea what to do with that. I don't know if I have to cut all the tree down or if I just need to trim it or anything. I'm clueless when it comes to that. But I've never done anything with them anyway. And, you know, they seem to produce fruit that we don't gather and falls off the tree eventually and rots in the flower bed. So that's the way it is. But at any rate, they're kind of pretty, you know, and things are hanging off of them. Lemons or something. I don't know what they are, but nature can sometimes register some false signals. We had a cold snap. Now we're supposed to get really warm, and we'll get really warm. And what might happen is, you know, when we lived in the Dakotas, we'd have this late spring storm where you'd get snow, like in the end of April or around the holiday season. And we get this snow, and then 2 days later, it's 75 degrees. And guess what happens? The trees begin to bud. And then all of a sudden there's another cold snap and, you know, things freeze and plants go haywire. And that's what happens with events in the world. You have something that really appears to speed up and then all of a sudden there's a cold snap. So just like the fig tree, just like this fig tree prophecy, you know, maybe you're just not reading all the signs and you have to be patient. Maybe the season is just not yet. So there may be some early warm spring weather in which flowers begin to bloom, but then and the leaves start to form in the trees only to be stalled with a cold snap or a frost later on. That's the way prophecy can be. Just as I said, like the waves of the ocean, in and out, in and out. That one's not in the Bible, but I think the principle is clear. The other thing that Christ mentions here is generation. We used to get hung up on that term generation. How long is a generation? Is it 25 or 30 years? You know, because the idea is that if you knew how long a generation was, then you could begin to determine how long it would be, how long this time of the end it would be until Christ returns, right? I mean, famines, war, pestilences, etc. But except that the word generation here does not mean a generation like we would think of it, like 30 years or whatever the round number is these days, whatever comprises a generation. It simply means age. So when all of these events begin to occur at the same time, if they're concurrent with one another, then fine. You know, you're watching the fig tree. You're seeing these things happen. They're about to happen. But, you know, you're forewarned because all of these things are definite signs that will precede the second coming of Christ. Wars, rumors of wars, famines. Of course, we've always had these things. All of them, really, when you get down to it, in one way or another, all through history, but we haven't had them all at one time squeezed into a little period of time. And, you know, I don't know what that little period of time is, but we'll know when we're there. And we're not there yet, in my view. So that leads us to the next principle of Bible prophecy, which you find, you know, the principle itself, you'll find many, many times in Bible prophecy, especially in the major and the minor prophets, and that is the phrase or variations of the phrase that day. That day. An example of this is found in Isaiah 2, verses 10 through 12. Well, a little bit further, even more after that, a few verses after, where, you know, we find the not only that day, but other similar phrases that help us to have a clue as to what is going to happen and how long that's going to be. Isaiah 2 verses 10 says, "Enter into the rock and hide in the dust, for the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day." What you find when you're studying that particular terminology and other similar ones like it is that there are a lot of things that are going to happen in that day, a lot of different things that are going to happen. You know, mankind is going to be terrorized by God in that day. At his return, much of mankind will be in terror, abject terror. Verse 12 says, "For the day of the Lord." So that day is the day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord, as we find out in Bible prophecy, means a period of time that's going to last 1,000 years. It's going to begin with the return of Jesus Christ and go right on up into the day of the millennium, because that's when God intercedes in the events of mankind. But as you know, there's a beginning and there's an end of those events. It's a finite period described as 1,000 years. But there are a lot of things that are going to happen in that initial period of in that day when God begins to intervene. And the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day, for the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Upon the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon the oaks of Bashan, these trees are symbolic of governments and institutions of mankind, as also the hills and the mountains and high towers and all of that are synonyms, or actually not synonyms, but symbols for governments. Verse 16, upon all the ships of Tarshish and upon all the beautiful sloops, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth, for the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. So in other words, there's not going to be any place on earth that will be excluded from God's judgment or the day of the Lord. Now, there are going to be many, many results of God's intervention. In fact, you can do a study on this particular, an online reference. You know, there are many different online references that I find handy, and they've got their own little concordances and quick searches. And I found 53 specific references in the major prophecies of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and 35 references in the minor prophets, which describe significant events that are going to take place in that day, or just at the very beginning of Christ's return. A lot of different things are going to happen. Isaiah 17 and verse 4 is one event that happens. In that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob will wane and the fatness of his flesh grow lean. So that's something. You know, the time of Jacob's trouble is another aspect, or even a prelude to the things that will happen in the day of the Lord. And I'm just going to cite these very, very quickly to save time. I borrowed my wife's watch. I'm not sure how you really tell time with this. The face is so dark. But I guess you do. Maybe your vision is better than mine. Zechariah 12 and verse 3, it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. This is one we'll come back to a little bit later. Isaiah 11 and verse 11, it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, and from Hamath and the islands of the sea. That's talking about a repatriation of the people of Israel. God is going to bring them out of captivity. Isaiah 11 and verse 10 says, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse who shall stand as a banner to the people. For the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. Speaking about the time of Christ's establishment of his government. Isaiah 19 and verse 24 says, in that day Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land. So there is a time during the millennium in which three nations will be prominent in the earth: Israel, Assyria, and Egypt. You know, the other two, Egypt and Assyria, have figured prominently in the history of Israel. Israel has never really figured prominently in their history except, you know, to go into captivity, you know, in certain times, you know, in ancient Egypt and ancient Assyria. But interesting, they're all going to be prominent in that day, but not the beginning, just at some point, you know, after Christ's return. Joel 3 and verse 18, it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drip with new wine, the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Acacias. So that obviously points to a time of prosperity, plenty. Again, it's obvious by inference that there's not just one thing or one period, one little, you know, 24-hour period, 2-week period, 1-year period called in that day. It encompasses many, many different events. So there are also some other phrases like the time of the end in Daniel 11 and verse 35, latter days, Daniel 10 verse 14, day of the Lord. All of these phrases actually speak about the day of Christ's return or the time period that begins the transition of man's rule to the kingdom of God. Now, that leads me to the next third principle. The third principle, the day for a year principle in understanding Bible prophecy. This one can be a little bit tricky, and it's there is one thing that I have found that I haven't really been able to. We once time taught. We're not really big on teaching it now, and that is the times of the Gentiles. You know, when do they end? And, you know, the seven times of Nebuchadnezzar's prophecy and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's a toughie because we could point to that ending in the early 80s, but we see nothing significant that really truly happened there totally. I mean, maybe some minor events in the whole scheme of things, work of Pope John Paul, Europe, you know, maybe coming together a little bit more, you know, leading to the fall of the Berlin Wall and stuff like that. But, you know, that one's a tricky one. So we're going to put that one on the shelf because obviously we don't understand that one well enough. But there are other ones that we do understand pretty well. I'm going to submit them to you. It's easy to surmise in the previous examples of the day of the Lord or in that day, for instance, that this is kind of easy for me. Although we talked about it after services in Sierra Vista. Somebody had a different opinion. I said, well, you know, my opinion is that just doesn't fit. I said, yeah, you know, it doesn't really. So it just doesn't. I mean, so we kind of went away agreeing on this one. But it's possible that Christ could return on the Day of Trumpets. Why? Well, just because it kind of fits with the meaning of the day. I'm not saying that it will or it won't, but it's possible, right? I mean, what better day would there be if it's going to meet with the meaning of the festival? So it could be that that day, the kingdom of God is set up at the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles, since the holy days are a shadow of events according and occurring in about a year's time. You could have some of those things happen, you know, just in sequence. But this day for a year principle is mentioned for the first time in Numbers 14:34. This took a long time for me to explain. This was bad time management on my part in Sierra Vista. So I'm going to kind of do a better job on it now. I gave the dry run. Now you're getting the real thing. Numbers 14 and verse 34. You remember when the spies were sent out to spy the land in the previous chapter. And they came back with what? An evil report. And they were about to go in and possess the land. Remember? Two men, Caleb, and they had good reports. The others, not so good. I don't know if it was Joshua. Yeah. Wasn't? Okay. Two good reports, 10 bad reports. And so what did God say? Numbers 14 and verse 34. They didn't want to go in. Everybody was scared. So according to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. So that's where the first instance that I know of is recorded in the Bible where a day is kind of translated to a year. In this sense, it was they were being punished for 40 years. And most of them didn't make it. Apparently, you know, hardly any of them made it to actually see the promised land. So 40 years is a long time. So they were punished. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 26, beginning there, here's a mention of promises that were given to the descendants of Israel. These are like the most unbelievable promises, along with others, and, you know, we find a repetition of them in Genesis 48, 49, and other places. These are like the most unbelievable promises of bounty and wealth that one can imagine. There is no one like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to help you, and his excellency on the clouds. The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He will thrust out the enemy from before you and will say, "Destroy." Then Israel shall dwell in safety. The fountain of Jacob alone, in a land of grain and new wine, his heavens shall also drop dew. Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty. Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. But when you look in history, you find that these tribes are just kind of an afterthought in history. You hardly find them. I mean, did you have world history in high school? What was that, 11th grade for me? I think, see, my long-term memory is still pretty good. I'm just making it up, and no one can check the facts, but anyway, that's what I remember. But world history, I mean, you never find any mention of Israel, and it's so confused that everybody thinks that the only people that came out of Egypt were Jews, right? You know, that what happened to those other tribes? They don't even remember them. They have no idea that there are any. And, you know, maybe there's some vague memory of these lost tribes or whatever. Everybody's, oh, what? That's nonsense. That's silly. But there were 12 tribes, and you don't even find them mentioned in history books, basically. Why is that? Because these great promises were never fulfilled in biblical times. Oh, sure, yes, there was a period of time under Solomon, about 1,000 B.C., 1,000 years before Christ, when there was a united kingdom and a benevolent kingship or dictatorship under Solomon, and, you know, there was peace. But that was about it. All these blessings, the fatness of the land and under the land and the, you know, material wealth never happened in the Bible. In fact, what did happen in the Bible is that Israel departs from God, is carried away into captivity. We read that only, we only know that because we read it in, you know, you might find some histories, you know, you find a few, Josephus, and, you know, he's even not really thought of as a very significant historian by many, unless you're a Bible scholar, but you find some mention, Israel being carried away into captivity, just another story. But very rarely do you ever read about that when you're studying world history. Never, almost never. I never did. Just doesn't happen. The prominent nations anciently were the Persian kingdom, the Roman Empire, the Greeks. You know, for much of the Western world, don't even get into what happened in ancient times in China and, you know, the Philippines and the Far East or Africa. I mean, there's not much really known, not much recorded there. So the blessings that are mentioned here in Deuteronomy 33 were actually withheld for 2,520 years, as we know. And how do we get to that? Well, we get to that through this day for a year principle, and we just kind of do some backwards retrospective, and we can see that it basically came about. So Leviticus is a book of the law that shows Israel their national responsibility. And God promises them blessings for obedience and curse for disobedience. And he also specified a time period in which those blessings would be withheld if they were going to be disobedient. We know that. Leviticus 26 says that. Leviticus 26 and verse 18. And you can jot that down. I'll read this. "And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins." And so, as we all know, Israel did not obey God, and they were punished seven times. What does it mean? Again, the day for the year principle comes in and helps us to gain clarity to this particular prophecy. The Hebrew for times is shiba. In English, it is spelled S-H-I-B-A-H. And if you calculate that according to Roman numerals, no, I'm only kidding. The Hebrew for times is shima. It implies a duration or continuance of punishment. So a time is a year. It's a 360-day year. So they would be punished for seven times, or 7 times 360 days in a year. That's just based on the average lunar calendar of 12 months of 30 days. This is a prophetic time period of 7 times when Israel would not receive the blessings. So eventually those blessings that were given to Abraham, as you read in Genesis, fantastic, unbelievable blessings, then conferred upon his son Isaac, and then on to Jacob, and then on to Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. They got the vast majority of the national blessings of wealth that were conferred, but it didn't happen. Otherwise, you know, all of our history books would be chock-filled and brimming with how great Israel was in ancient times. But they are a footnote in history. You can't find almost any mention of them at all. But God said they would be great. So how do you begin to rationalize that? In Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, you know, this is bit by bit. It's a little complex, but it's pretty easy to understand. Ezekiel is now told, and he prophesied. This is where it's getting a bit dicey. Jeremiah was in the Babylonian captivity. I'm thinking 600, 700 BC, something like that. I can't remember. Anyway. But it was after the fact. This is something very interesting because it's all ancient to us, but it's not around the time of the judges or anything like that. It's much later. So Ezekiel is told in verse 4, "Lie also on your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of days that you lie on it, you shall bear their iniquity. For I have laid on you the years of their iniquity." Here's the day for your principal being given again. "According to the number of days, 390 days, so you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Israel." So in this instance, the prophet Ezekiel was required to bear their sins that Israel had in rejecting God as their ruler and his law. And of course, we know that he basically let them go for a period of time. This is saying that he let them go for 390 years from the time that they rejected. And the time that they began to reject God was in the time of the judges, just after the time of the judges. 1 Samuel 8, verses 4, and you can read through the rest of the chapter. You know, the elders came together and they said, "We don't want you to judge us anymore, and your sons are corrupt, so we want a king." And God told Samuel, "Okay, let them have what they want. They're not rejecting you. They are rejecting me." And so, although through the history of Israel, you'll find a few good phases, right? As I mentioned, David, Solomon a little bit, maybe a few other times when the tribes were united and then they split up. But you find that after, you know, God let them go on their own, and for a period of 390 years, they were left on their own. They just got more corrupt. They departed even further away from God over an almost 400-year period. And eventually, when did they go into captivity? The Assyrians took them into captivity in 721. Coincidentally, ding, 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 1111 BC is when these elders came to Samuel and asked for a king. And so that's when Saul came to prominence. That's when Saul came to power. You subtract that from it, and then, you know, that's when they went into captivity. So long after the fact that the northern kingdom had fallen, and during the time of the prophet Ezekiel, God showed him the effect this decision had on the nation of Israel. He said, 390 days, I'm going to punish them, and that's for that same period. That's the time that I have punished them. And during that time, God sent prophets. He tried to warn them to repent, but eventually we know they went into captivity 390 years exactly after Israel asked for a king and didn't want God to rule over them. So therefore, taking a long way to get there, but I can't help this. It's a little bit complex. It's not my story, okay? I'm too much of a simpleton to have something so complex. But the blessings were withheld. They had no chance to receive these blessings because they went into captivity. So the blessings were withheld for 7 times. or 2,250 years from the time they went into Assyrian captivity, and then all of a sudden, bingo, around the year 1800 and 1803, the United States and Britain both, well, Britain a little bit earlier, but, you know, both about the same time, they began to be unbelievably powerful and wealthy. You know, the 19th century was certainly the 100 years of dominance. 100 years of dominance by the British Empire. They were unbelievably magnificent and controlled the commerce and the wealth of the entire world. A nation of, in the 1800s, I can't imagine them being more than 15 or 20 million people. And there's about 60 million that live on the island of the UK now. I mean, and they controlled the world. You know, vast portions of the world, the Orient and India and Africa and so many places. It's incredible. And then the 20th century was the American century. No one can deny that. And no one can explain it either. How did it happen? How did it occur? Well, it's because God's blessings began to come into prominence. And you cannot, I mean, people, this is a blind spot that people have in understanding who Israel is. Another key, although I won't number it today because that would give me more than seven, and you know you have to have 7 points, so just have 7 points for the sermon. That's the way sermons work. But when you think of the greatness of the nations that were prior to that time, Spain and Italy and Portugal, seafaring nations, what have they amounted to in history? Virtually nothing. You know, a difference in attitude, difference in the way they did. You know, Spain sent ships out to conquer the world and, you know, extract wealth, bring it back to Spain. Portugal the same way. They eventually carved up the whole world. You know, the Pope allowed them to. You read that in world history, didn't you? That the Pope made a declaration that, you know, Spain would control this part of the world and Portugal. You know, he was, the Pope was the king of everything. And they drew a line on the known maps at that time and, you know, this portion is Spain's, this portion is Portugal's. You know, they controlled vast portions of the globe, but not for very, very long. You know, think about, you know, the Vikings in 1000 AD came to this country, couldn't establish a foothold here. They never amounted to anything great on a national scale. The French, wow, how crazy that is. I mean, they were everywhere, but now they're nowhere, right? I mean, it just, they were everywhere, but Canada, the U.S., you know, the Caribbean. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, God brought his prophecy to pass. Amos chapter 9 and verses 8 and 9. This is a prophecy of what would happen to these people as they went into captivity and came out of captivity. Behold, the eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom. Israel has always been special to God, always, and I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yet I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, says the Lord, for surely I will command and will sift the house of Israel among all nations as a grain is sifted in a sieve, yet not the smallest grain shall fall to the ground. In this prophecy, God promises that the descendants of Israel would be preserved until they were ready, until such a time that they could receive and develop the promised blessings of land and wealth. And even today, although we're not, I guess, at the peak of our power, we could be very easily. We see on the horizon very easily, I think, a scenario in which the blessings are taken away, eroded, you know, very quickly. You know, how quickly things can happen. You know, they were, I was listening to a news report the other day, the International Monetary Fund is seeking another currency that will become the world's currency, not the dollar. If that were to happen, then you'd probably add at least another dollar to every gallon of gasoline because it's going to be traded in some other currency and not in dollars anymore. We would lose yet one more foothold that we have to our wealth around the world. And most of it we're printing now anyway and borrowing from the Chinese and other nations. But Over 70% of all wealth in the world is controlled by those two nations, and especially by our nation now. But the promises help explain why Israel and Judah were insignificant in terms of secular history, and nobody knows who they are now. Nobody knows who the tribes of Israel are now and how prominent they would be in the 19th and 20th century. Micah chapter 5 and verse 8 is a prophecy that, in the most general of senses, mentions the strength and the power of modern day Israel. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who if he passes through both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. The word remnant shows those who have been sifted and remain at the time of the end. No one can overcome. Now, the power is still there. The ability to always use it is sometimes reluctant. See Korea, see Vietnam, see some of the, you know, even whether you think we did a noble thing in Iraq and Afghanistan, or whether it's a total debacle, the power has been there. What nations have been like this since the time of the early 1800s? None. I mean, nobody could stand up against the United States in if we were to exert all of our muscle and military might. We would just go through them like a hot knife through butter if we're committed, if we're totally committed. So verse 9 says, your hand shall be lifted against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. And we're not well liked in many parts of the world. I was listening to a news report from Egypt. One of the reporters was asking people who are demonstrating today in the streets of Cairo, what do you think of the U.S.? And they say, U.S. 50-50. You know, we like the American people. We don't like their system. Okay, I'm not sure that they know that much about the system, but they're protesting against it. Now, how do we get to that? Where do we understand where these blessings are? It's just several places. Deuteronomy 33. Here are these fantastic blessings. I mean, we're just people like anybody else, but you can go 60 miles from here and you can find that a country that is relatively as rich in mineral resources as we are in Mexico, as relatively natural resources, mineral wealth, and the like, and yet it's totally different, except in, you know, resort areas and that sort of thing. But they don't have the kind of middle class that we have. They don't have the opportunity that we have in this country, and it's just not the same, as you know. It's totally different. And that's why we have such a problem with people coming across our borders. But in Deuteronomy 33 and verse 13, it says, and of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord is his land, with the precious things of heaven, with the dew, and the deep lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. You know, an even separate, special, outstanding blessing on Joseph and his progeny, apart from the rest of the brothers who are Jacob's sons. And the crown on the head of him who was separate from his brothers, his glory is like a firstborn bull, and his horns like the horns of the wild ox. Together with him he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. So, incredible blessings. And now you know why they came to prominence. You knew beforehand, I know that. But now, that's the other part of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. The rest of the story. The fourth principle, the Bible is a record of the nation of Israel and the nations that come into contact with it, come into contact with Israel. Kind of a reverse of your world history texts. World history texts mention nothing about Israel. The Bible mentions nothing about other nations except when they come into contact with Israel. So you have Israel as prominently displayed. It's a book about Israel. And you have to understand that to understand prophecy. And then there are other nations that rise and fall and come into contact. And they are major players in a world scene, but they're not really anything special because these are peoples that are outside of the plan of God. God has a plan for them later on. But when you turn to Genesis chapter 48, you find that there's a chapter here that talks about the birthright blessings. And this is a prelude to it. And I'm just going to read a few verses of this chapter and then skip ahead to chapter 49. But in Genesis 48, it says, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you.' And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed." This was a time for a great ceremony, unbelievable transference of wealth that eventually would come to pass in 1800, 1803. So many things came into our possession as a nation in the United States alone that it boggles the mind. You know, Florida and from the Spanish and Louisiana Purchase from the French, and then the movement westward by settlers and pioneers to claim the rest of this country. It's just, you know, it's an amazing story. I mean, it's just unbelievable still when you think about it. And it all happened or all began to come to pass at this particular time because Joseph, who had been sold into slavery by his brothers and preserved the nation of Egypt with his wisdom and God's wisdom, had these two sons, and he named them Ephraim and Manasseh. And, you know, these blessings of Abraham that were going to be passed right down to these two young boys. And in verse 14 of Genesis 48, "Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly. For Manasseh was the firstborn, and he blessed Joseph and said, 'God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth.'" But it didn't happen then. And it didn't happen for thousands of years. Thousands of years. And then, boom. You know, what was the population of the United States in 1800? Couldn't have been much more than 5 million. And we're 300 million today. And 60 million in Great Britain, 360 million people have controlled the vast majority of wealth on this earth. That is astounding. And when I think of something happening in Egypt, the reason I kind of, and I want to jump to conclusion because I've been through these things before. In 1973, I was there. We had a church member that was living in Israel during the time of the that war, and then, you know, 7 years prior to that, in 66, we had the Six-Day War, and, you know, the Yom Kippur War in 1973, and, wow, you go through a few of those, and you realize, as a church member, that you don't just jump in and buy in right now, and, okay, get on the bandwagon of prophecy, and this is mentioned. I mean, you know, in just general terms, the greatness of Israel in wars, multiple wars, is mentioned in one little verse, you know, as a young lion and will tread down, you know, wherever he wants to go. So this conference of the blessings would happen many years afterwards. And in Genesis 49, you see his last word to the rest of the sons. Okay, here's what's going to happen to the rest of you 11. And, you know, not as much. I mean, but we can identify those nations pretty much, or those peoples pretty much, by what is said about them. Point number 5, the importance of Judah. We began with the principle of fig tree in Matthew 24 as a principle for understanding Bible prophecy. What I'm giving you today is really not exhaustive. There are many, many ways to look at prophecy, but One of the things that I think is certainly relevant is that passage that we read in Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 3. I don't think we've emphasized this as much as we could have in even our writings, but in Zechariah 12 and verse 3 it says, "And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away surely will be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it." Today we live in a world, and you know, the Suez Canal, as I mentioned, very, very important, and that's why it's kind of easy to, you know, okay, wonder what's going to happen in Egypt because they control that. What's going to happen because Egypt is the biggest nation of all of the Arab states, 80 million people. Will it have a domino effect if they fall to fundamental Islamic control? Will that happen all around the Middle East with all the other nations? And then Israel is totally surrounded anyway by nations that absolutely detest them and would love to move them into the sea. And, you know, I guess this is the good news of this prophecy. It's not going to happen, because anybody that's going to try is going to find themselves in a fight. And especially during the time of the end, even all the nations of the earth are gathered against it, God is not going to let them be destroyed. So the entire chapter of Zechariah 12 shows that God is going to come to the rescue of Jerusalem and destroy all nations that try to come against it. There have been some significant events in our lifetimes that have happened, but there are going to be some other significant events that will precede God's intervention. Now, back in Matthew, I did skip numbering one thing for you, so I had five, which was Judah's importance. And I left out six, which was 2 Peter 3:8, which I won't take the time to describe since I just went over it. 2 Peter 3:8 says, "Do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day." Relevant from this standpoint, there's been 6,000 years of man and then 1,000-year reign of Christ. That's another important point. We're still in the 6,000 years. In Matthew chapter 24, Christ speaks of an abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And we know from history, from historical accounts, that this happened between the Testaments initially. Initially, this happened between the Testaments. But Christ, with Antiochus Epiphanes, and I think you've all heard about that and read about it, it's kind of touched upon in Daniel 11 a little bit, and we know what, you know, happened in ancient times, where the Maccabees revolted against the Seleucid dynasty, you know, basically one of the offshoots of Alexander the Great's dynasty, one of the four offshoots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the Maccabees, who were nationalists, revolted against them when they tried to desecrate the temple, the rebuilt temple at that time. Christ speaks in Matthew 24 and verse 15 of a modern time desolation. It says, "Whoever reads, let him understand." You know, something similar to what happened and was spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And that brings us to the last point, the last principle. That is the biblical principle of duality. You know, things happen as a type, and then there's a latter fulfillment. You know, Christ came at his first coming. He's going to come at his second coming. There is a principle of duality that happens in the Bible. So does this mean that there might be a rebuilding of the temple in modern times, and, you know, the place where they would like to rebuild a Jewish temple would be in Arab control right now? Does that mean what it's going to be, or is it going to be a spiritual thing? It says that there's going to be a time when armies surround Jerusalem, and that's an abomination that makes desolate. So, you know, we'll have to wait on that. But one of the most important things is found in the previous verse. "This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." That is like, you know, a very, very powerful statement. You know, what the church does with that, you know, is very, very important. What happens under the auspices of the two witnesses, I feel, is going to be very important and very powerful. And then Christ is going to return. The main thing is, you know, you can really get into the nitty-gritty. We've gotten into a little bit of the detail today and can be complex. I don't think it's complex to you. You've studied it for years. But I think it's good to be aware of what is happening in the world around us. Obviously, we do. But I think this is really an important key to prophecy that we need to be foundationally rooted to, is our part in doing what we can to promulgate that gospel. And I've been very pleased, especially mentioned that, you know, the report that Mr. Tannert brought back to us last week from the conference, that is the avowed purpose. And, you know, it seems like, wow, this is such a crazy thing. You know, we're such a small group and we are entrusted with this particular job, this particular fulfillment of this prophecy. We look for ways to handle that. And it's a big job. It's really big. Thank goodness and thank God, rather, that you've all been called to that purpose. And, you know, all the rest of this stuff is kind of fun to look. But don't jump to conclusions is the main point here. 7 points, 7 principles of prophecy. And I think it's very encouraging as we look to the future that, you know, Israel is going to be saved out of its trouble. Jacob is going to be saved out of its trouble, as God says. But remember the parable of the fig tree as you're studying prophecy and the waves of the ocean analogy. And that will stand us in good stead as we go forward into the future.